You joined Bentley around Christmas time, you're saying?
Yeah, I joined Bentley a couple of weeks before Christmas. So it was a peak time to join the company,
Yes.
to say the least. And I had just come off the Black Friday rush at Mex. So I was kind of taking off the Mex hat that had to do with fashion, putting on more of the travel and commodity one for Bentley. Yeah, so it was a quick transition, to say the least.
So, how long had Bentley actually had a transactional website online?
They were transactional since 2011, and we're relaunching the website sometime in April. And we have the Bentley site, and we're also excited that we have a new company called Blackbook,
Ah,
and
okay.
it's actually going to be a high-end retail goods company. So there's going to be some brands like Briggs & Riley and Brix and Tumi on there. So selling high-end wallets and backpacks and luggages, and completely different market segment than Bentley. So the team is going to be getting ready to launch not one but two sites that are both bilingual in English and French.
Wow, well,
Yeah.
that's gonna be you're gonna be busy
Yeah,
then. Well, and
Oh,
it's exciting because there's a lot
very.
of potential to do stuff.
Yeah.
So how do you deal with the challenge of selling stuff online when you've also got a bunch of retail stores? Is there any risk of cannibalization or is that not an issue?
It's funny because so at Next there was 90 stores, and at
Right.
Bentley there's almost 400. So it's if I ever thought Mex had a lot of stores, Bentley definitely has a lot. So you can always
Right.
find Bentley now. And this is something that I think people that work at stores too have to wrap their head around sometimes. But digital supports that. The e-com operation supports stores. And I'll give you a prime example. We have a feature that checks the availability in store. So you
Yes.
can go on a product and then check if it's available in store. That's just one of the examples where we're supporting the stores. And
Yeah.
a lot of times people walk into the stores, and I hear from operations all the time, it's like that the price, for some reason or another, at Bentley there was sometimes wrong pricing. Which shouldn't happen. It's the same price level, but there's errors that happen. So the customer would go into the store. I mean, they're pretty savvy. They would go into the store and say, "Hey, it's $10 cheaper online,"
Yeah.
and that's a really easy sell. So we definitely have that. And then there's the store locator features, which on mobile are probably the most popular or some of the most popular pages.
Yeah.
So there's that, and I think also when you use the stores as a return mechanism.
Yes.
Customer orders online, and in fashion is probably even a better example, where the size might not be the right, or the fit might not be right, where the color was off a bit. So they go return it because it's free. They go to return it in stores, and
Yes.
that's a prime upsell or cross-sell opportunity for the stores. I think sometimes the stores always use online as taking away revenue stream from them, but I think it adds bit, or it could add bit for some of the savvy employees at the store level.
I mean, it's probably too soon to say at Bentley, but at Max, did you provide any kind of special training to store staff so that they could take advantage of those opportunities?
We work closely with operations to outline some of the concerns they would have. I think where we can bring value as a digital team is providing those analytics to the stores. And I remember one of the best ones that they liked was time on site and store locator. So we told them how many people visit our site and which stores or which locations they were in. So especially in the small central towns, we would show them those reports and say, "Okay, you got 70 visits for online for, let's say, a small little city." And sharing some of those reports is very helpful, and then emails as well. So I mean, it's no secret when you have 90 stores in the case of Next and 400 in the store in the case of Bentley, most of the newsletter subscribers probably come from the store level at some point.
Yes, yeah.
So we support in that way to push people into stores or online to make purchases. And sharing some of those metrics with, you know, the district managers is also vital, because, you know, you're saying, you know, 1 in 5 or 1 in 4 people open this email, and, you know, this percentage clicked through and probably came into your store.
Right.
So I think there's a, you know, they call it a ripple effect research, online purchase offline. So, you know, everyone's trying to figure out what exactly that number is, and you have to look at your metrics to even come close to analyzing that.
So one of the ways then of getting store buy-in, you're saying, is to give them the metrics that at least are indicative that people use the website likely to get themselves to the store.
Absolutely. And I always make it clear. I mean, the conversion rate in Canada, everyone talks, is, you know, between 1 and 2, let's say for a multi-channel retailer, 1 and 2%. There's 98% of people not checking out.
Right.
So those people are generally going to the store, just adding to cart and, you know, seeing what other competitors are doing.
Yep.
So there's a huge opportunity in e-commerce, yes, but the majority are still not purchasing online.
Right.
So to say that, you know, we're cannibalizing sales, I don't think is something
that
they should. It's very premature, I think. You know, maybe in 4 or 5 years we can talk more seriously about that, but I think at this point it's still a bit too nascent to go that route.
So let's talk, to the extent that you can, a little bit about, you said that when you joined Bentley, you discovered that there were a lot of issues with the web and how web-related customer service had been handled. Can you talk a little bit about what some of the issues have been and how you're planning on dealing with those?
Yeah, I think one of the main issues was response time, in terms of responding to the customer's needs, either by phone, by email, on social. We haven't done a good enough job on either of those three, and that's something that we're going to put processes in place to make sure that, you know, whether it's on social or a phone call, that they'll be responded to in X amount of hours and X amount of days, because that was happening all too often. And a lot of times we realized, because I did have some calls with customers, if you can believe it or not, in my first week, and one of the things that I realized was they just wanted to be heard.
Right. Now, will you be finding ways, to what extent will you be able to integrate your systems so that people answering, whether it's the live chat or the social media staff or customer service, is it integrated in a way that any of those could easily and quickly get a picture of what's going on with that customer?
Yeah, so, and we're still working on finalizing the makeup of the team, but on the customer service side, 100% they'll have that whole 360 view.
Okay.
The question becomes, now what happens if a retail customer calls in or has an issue?
Right.
Is that the same person or people that are responding, or is there a dedicated one for online? Because it's a bit more complex, and, you know, they have to maybe log into Magento to check some order shipments, and then is there one for or resources for retail and wholesale? So that's still to be worked out. Ideally, the online is an extension, you know, for online and strictly tied to online. And the only other thing too is then social, because social obviously is you know, you have your branded channel and your branded, let's say, whether it's promos or stuff that you want to promote, products, new pushes, campaigns. But you also have the customer service angle.
People
want to know about their orders, or want to know when there's a certain sale or when free shipping is. So there's a customer service side to that. So I think some retailers, you know, incorporate that in service, and some have the social team doing it, or some have other marketing people do it. That's something that we're going to look at to maybe integrate fully as a customer service piece when it's related to a specific order or question.
Okay. Would you still then have other social media people who do just sort of ongoing posting type stuff? Or?
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly. We would treat it separately.
Okay. And have you decided then, in terms of what staffing levels, what is necessary for an operation of this size?
We're still building that team out, but I will say this. Well, you know, I don't know today if it's 4 people or 6 people that we launch with. They will not be specialists per se. They will be able to jump in, you know, perhaps write content for an email and write a Facebook post one and the same.
Okay.
So there might be a social media, let's say, department or person, but they will be expected to either be a backup for each other or know how to do each other's roles. And, you know, we'll have, our e-commerce specialist might be, you know, a digital marketing person plus a project coordinator, plus an implementation specialist type thing.
Well, it's going to be tough to find.
Tough to find.
How do you plan on handling the 24/7 nature of an online store?
Good question. And one of the things I know Bentley has, you know, people talk about 9 to 5. Bentley is, you know, 8 to 4:30. And and on Friday.
I discovered that when I phoned you.
Yeah, exactly, right? But you know, one of the talks I had with my boss was, you know, e-commerce is not a 9 to 5 job. So we might have people that, you know, come in a bit later, whether it's 9:30 or 10, but they're going to finish at 6 and 7. And same with social, you know, that whoever handles social might be expected to have a cell phone so that they can answer on weekends and answer on nights. And you know, they don't have to spend hours and hours, but, the point is that anyone we bring on has to love this, this industry and this sector because it's always on. And, you know, even when I'm away or I'm on vacation, there's a part of me that stays here and, you know, if there's an issue, someone's gotta be, counted on to kind of push that through. And
right.
If people expect it to be 9 to 5, it's hard because most of your customers are, if they're not shopping at lunch, they're most of them shopping online and some of them very late into the night. And, you know, so it's advantageous for you to maybe shift your schedules around to cater to your customers. I mean, especially if peak traffic is at night. You know, I'm not saying employees should work at until 8 o'clock every night. But there are
well, times. unless you hire people specifically to work those types of shifts.
Yeah, and that's the advantage. I know a lot of I don't recommend it, but a lot of people will outsource some customer service because of that. And I think there are times to outsource customer service, and maybe it's that, you know, during the, you know, 8 p.m. to kind of 6 a.m. or 7 a.m. type time frames. But I still think it's important to keep that centralized or internal.
Although ultimately your social media staff need to get some sleep.
Absolutely, right? or you hire 5 of them.
Yeah, exactly. Let's hope they're all insomniac.
Exactly, which I think they usually are, right? Social.
Yeah. Probably. Okay, so in terms of customer service then, improving responsiveness, one of the things, and I gather the thing that you were planning to talk about at the ETAL conference was to do with surprising and delighting customers when they receive a parcel. So let's just step back here for a moment to Mex, which perhaps, you know, given its situation, might not be the best example. But let's talk about what you were planning initially to say at the conference and what your perspective is on how that was working.
Yeah, so one of the things we did at Mex was write handwritten letters. Literally, my team would write handwritten letters. And we didn't do it for every single order every single day, but we took some orders each day for a period of about 3 weeks, separate times, and we wrote them thank you notes. And they were actually handwritten. It wasn't like one and then they were photocopied. They were handwritten and personalized. And so the operations of this has to be kind of on point. And they were signed, and there was a hashtag that, you know, either said love Mex or tell your Mex story or something like that,
okay,
where we try to track that and see what happened. And we got some calls, actually, about it, saying, you know, that was pretty neat. We appreciate that. And some of them, you know, might have ordered just, you know, an accessory or something. So they were caught aback that we would take the effort to actually write that. So I think they got a kick out of that. And it's something that we're definitely going to do at Bentley, and maybe even on a far-reaching scale, because I think we need to.
You said you had a hashtag and we're encouraging basically to share that. Do you have any idea what sort of uptake you got? What percentage actually did share something publicly about their experience?
It was about a 2% rate that that responded back. Now, we didn't send this to, you know, a million customers, so it was still small scale. And then because the clientele at Mix was a bit older, we actually had probably 5% of them call.
Wow. Okay.
Because they were, you know, the Mex customer was probably at times 35, 40, 45. So whether they had social channels or not, that was one of the learnings, was like, oh, more people called. we did have that. We put a hashtag and we put our 1-800 number right there. Yeah, some of them called. So we really went into it, you know, not saying it would be a success or failure if we hit this or if we hit that. Mm-hmm. We just wanted to test it a bit. We thought it was a pretty neat idea because we were always trying to find something different to do. Because, you know, we did the bounce backs and that was cool. But
what do you mean the bounce back?
Just depending on what they ordered or if the customer was a repeat customer or not, we'd put a bounce back, like a postcard inside, giving them X amount on their next order. And, you know, one of the other things we did to kind of surprise and delight, we had some emails automated, and we had, you know, we were really big on customer lifetime value. And while it was a manual process at Mix because there were certain systems that were trying to work together, so there was some experts involved and some massaging of data. What we did was we wanted to reward our best customers. So, you know, when we pulled, you know, reports every 3 months and every 6 months on who our best customers were, we gave them, we sent out some personalized emails that were basically one-to-one type relationships. You know, we weren't sending the same emails to multiple people. And depending on what amounts that they had ordered and how many orders they had made in the last, you know, 3 months or 6 months, we gave them a pretty good deal. And it was even sometimes higher than our loyalty members would get.
Okay. So how do you make something like this handwritten personalized letters? How do you scale that?
It's difficult to scale. And I think once you do scale, sometimes you lose that that personal feel to it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if I had about 125 employees here, I wouldn't ask each of them to write, you know, 10 letters a day. Because I think if everyone gets it, then it's less personal. But I would definitely do it for your best customers, your most satisfied customers, and probably even the customers you've disappointed the most. I think those are the segments that I would concentrate heavily on for that type of program. Because it does take a bit of time to write, and you know, most people aren't used to writing anymore.
Yeah.
Everyone's used to typing. So I know my team looked at me funny when I said, let's write them stuff.
And I always had lousy handwriting. It's even worse now.
That's what made it fun, actually, because they even signed it. So you knew it was real. You can see the ink on it. And yeah, handwriting is, it's always tough. But I think it's different when you open that package and it's different, right? Like Amazon does a great job, but you know, when you open that Amazon package, it's always going to be the same. So when you get something that's out of the ordinary or surprising, I think that's when that whole delight comes in, where you're caught off guard a bit.
And of course, the delighted customer is much more likely to tell their friends.
Absolutely.
Even if they don't do it on social media.
Yep.
It's much more likely to spread.
Yep.
Talk a bit about how you plan to reestablish the relationship with disappointed customers. So, I mean, there are discounts and stuff, and you're saying the customized letters or personalized letters. How do you actually approach it? Like, are you actually going to say, look, we know we've kind of screwed up in the past and we're starting to do better or planning to do better? How do you handle that?
Yeah, I think that's definitely one way to kind of, and I wouldn't do it for all customers. I think we're going to have to group them very, very differently and deal with them very, very differently. And whether that's 10 segments or 15 segments of, you know, great customers, good customers, we disappointed you guys, we really disappointed you guys, we really screwed up. So I think once you get through that, and then each of those strategies will be a bit different, and some of them I think deserve phone calls.
Yeah.
I think some of them will be phone calls, which, you know, they might get even more upset about. But we have to try. We have to really try to make this better. And worse comes to worse, I mean, they probably wouldn't have ordered again. But the fact that there's some newness to the team, there's some newness to the site, there's some newness to the company because the company is going through a big transformation, I would hope gets them excited. And,
yeah, it gives you a good opportunity for a fresh start.
Yeah.
It gives you a good excuse to make that connection.
Yeah, and you know, I really, you know, everybody wants 50% off. Everybody, right? And I don't think that's necessarily the way to go about it, but I think something like free shipping for a year or $1
yeah.
shipping for the next, for all the, for the entire month, those little things, go a long way. Or you know, customers that order, maybe putting a freebie in their basket or in their order. Those are the type of things that we're going to look at for each different segment. So I can guarantee that they'll all have different strategies, and the scaling part will be interesting on some of those.
Walking into a situation like this, how do you even start? Where do you set your priorities? How do you decide what should be the priorities? Because there's so much that needs to be done.
One thing I kept looking at, I kept asking, where are the processes and where are the current processes? Where are the current processes? And the answer usually was there aren't any. And
right.
that could be very, very scary to operate e-commerce like. So for me, it was pretty easy because I'm like, okay, we're not going to go forward until we fix what's gonna launch. So we basically are drafting continuously processes for, you know, examples include, you know, how an order comes through, how a refund is processed, how a return policy is drafted up, email, digital marketing. So from A to Z, we're looking at all the processes that need to be created to support e-commerce, you know, returns at store, that type of stuff. Wasn't really outlined, and so some of it was ad hoc or some of it wasn't thought about. You have to have strong processes in order to succeed or to win at e-commerce, because you've got
yes.
the best team in the world, but if they're lost and they don't know kind of
yeah.
Where to go, I think people won't be able to succeed.
Absolutely.
Processes was the biggest thing for me to wrap my head around, because I was used to, you know, maybe there were processes that were broken, but they were existent.
Do you have any other thoughts on customer service and the relationship between online and offline customer service?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I think when we talk about a multi-channel retailer and customer service versus, you know, pure play like shop.ca or Beyond the Rack, our service extends to all our stores.
Right.
And sometimes you can't control that service.
Right.
So I think one of the challenges for multi-channel retailers is to make sure that that service is consistent throughout the organization. Because we can offer the best service and the customer gets the order and they have three items and they're going to return one and they walk into the store and the, you know, salesperson or employee at the store doesn't want to help them. And I think that's a big challenge that multi-channel retailers are facing. Because we, like especially e-commerce, we can do our end. And you just hope sometimes that the consistency is there.